When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Katie Lambert.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy. And our Medici Super Series isn't all about Italy. In this episode, we're actually going to follow the most famous female member of the Medici clan on her journey to France, where this wealthy bourgeois family finally attains what it hasn't had, which is royal standing.
But it's not all happily ever after. You have probably heard of Catherine as a poisoner or an Italian spy, but we're saving that stuff, the Catholic Huguenot Wars, for later, and Catherine's triple regency as well. For this one, we're going to go back to her roots.
And that's because apparently we're really fascinated by stories about sad royal children. I was thinking about all the episodes where we've talked about them. Cleopatra's brood, Herod's kids, Elizabeth I when she was Elizabeth with kind of an expendable head. So we're going to move on to Florence and start with a really sad childhood.
In our Michelangelo episode, we talked about a Medici Pope, Pope Leo the X, as our friend Molly from Stuff Mom Never Told You called him, and his various maneuvers in Florence for power. He assumed the papal throne in 1513 and replaced his brother as nominal ruler of Florence with his nephew, a puppet, Lorenzo II de' Medici, and don't get him confused with Lorenzo the Magnificent because there's nothing
Not
like
the
that
same
about
guy.
Him.
Yeah.
And Leo arranges an advantageous match for this young man with Madeleine de la Tour d'Auvergne, who's a 16-year-old orphan and also a Bourbon heiress. It's a deal struck up between the Pope and the Italian territory-hungry French king Francis I, which suits both of their schemes and is a nice little union of power.
And the marriage is a success. The couple conceives a child within months. And Caterina de' Medici is born on April 13th, 1519. But the sad thing is, she's orphaned within weeks of her birth because Lorenzo II seems to have had a pretty bad case of syphilis.
Francis and Leo are, of course, disappointed that their plan hasn't come to fruition quite as they were hoping. But once baby Catherine gets over an early illness, she's healthy and actually turns out to be a very valuable pawn to whoever possesses her. Pope Leo intends to control her himself and refuses to send her to Francis's court because basically she'd be a hostage there.
Yeah, Francis would be the one who could decide who to marry her to. And so when Leo receives baby Catherine in Rome, he says somewhat ominously, she comes bearing the calamities of the Greeks, but he also says she's a fine and fat little baby, so maybe things are going to come out okay. Leo puts his full power behind Catherine and makes her Duchess of Urbino. He plans to eventually marry her off to an illegitimate Medici son and set them up as the new puppet rulers of Florence. But unfortunately, things aren't so simple, and in 1521, Leo dies, and the new pope is Adrian VI, who's a reformist. We talked about him in the Michelangelo episode, too. He has little tolerance for all things Medici, and it's not a good time for the family.
Adrian at first takes Catherine's Duchy of Urbino and gives it back to its original owners, but even though the family is flailing a bit at this time, Catherine's doing okay. She's moved back to Florence to live under her relative Cardinal Giulio's supervision, and you might remember him from our Pazzi Conspiracy podcast. He was the illegitimate son of the Giuliano who was murdered in the Duomo. But Adrian doesn't last long anyways. He dies, possibly being poisoned, just 2 years after he comes into power.
And so Catherine's uncle, Cardinal Giulio, becomes Pope Clement VII. And with the Medici back on top, back in power, Catherine becomes good marriage bait again. She's valuable again. And so Clement outfits her in style in the Medici Palace. You know, she's raised like a princess there. But as we mentioned also in the Michelangelo podcast, Florentines are not happy under this new form of Medici rule. Cardinal Giulio, now Pope Clement, isn't willing to give up his day job of micromanaging Florence, and the people in the city aren't happy under this Medici control.
And in 1526, when Catherine is just 7 years old, Clement joins a sort of league with France, England, Florence, and Venice against the eventual Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. But things do not go well for the League of Cognac, and soon enough, imperial troops are sacking Rome. The Pope has to flee, hide, and melt down his papal tiaras to pay his own ransom. And as, of course, we learned in a previous podcast, while Rome is being sacked, the Florentines take the opportunity to try to restore the Republic. And with the help of the imperial army, they overthrow the Medici.
Yeah, down with the Medici. And so this is obviously scary times for Catherine de' Medici, holed up in the Medici Palace. And she's there with her guardian and mother figure, Clarice Strozzi, who the two of them are left to face this angry anti-Medici Florentine mob. And eventually they escape to a Medici country house, but an armed escort comes to collect Catherine and takes her off to the Santa Lucia convent, which is not a pro-Medici convent, but still probably a relatively safe place to be. And this begins poor Catherine's 3 years of danger and shuffling about. And from Santa Lucia, she's moved to Santa Caterina of Siena, which is also in Florence. And it's a plague-ridden convent, so not the best place for a young girl to be living.
The French ambassador insists that she be taken out of it, and the Republic's council agreed for her to move to the convent of Santa Maria Annunziata delle Murate, which is a covert operation. They leave in the dead of night. Catherine is wearing several veils, and this is in 1527, just to give you an idea of where we are in the timeline
of her life. Yeah, people sometimes ask for more dates and ages and biographies.
We're giving you dates.
But this convent is much nicer than the other two. It's set up to educate young aristocratic women, and they also take in retired noble women. And since the convent has been well supported by the Medici, they're very welcoming to Catherine. The abbess is even her godmother, so it's comparatively nice. She learns a lot from these educated aristocratic nuns and picks up a lot of the things that make her eventually so successful in court, you know, her nice manners, her beautiful bearing, her charm. And one of the nuns notes that she was so gentle and pleasant that the sisters did all they could to ease her sorrows and difficulties. So this is a calmer time in her imprisonment, essentially.
But in the meantime, Clement and Charles are hammering out a peace, but new extremists in Florence fear that the Medici will come back into power, of course, if Clement and Charles are together on this. So they consider eliminating the main marriage pawn, who, of course, is little Catherine.
Precious to the papacy and the Medici. And in 1529, with imperial troops arriving in Florence, these new extremists meet them with a fierce defense. This is when Michelangelo is setting up the fortification, designing fortifications and all that. And these extremists are very anti-11-year-old Catherine, and they have some terrible ideas about what to do with her. One plan is to lower her naked in a basket over the city walls where her imperial allies might accidentally kill her. Another is to ditch her in a military brothel so that she's not a very desirable marriage pawn anymore.
They don't accomplish any of these, but regardless, the plan is to take her out of the Marate convent, and the poor nuns have to give her up. Catherine thinks that the troops are coming to kill her, so she shaves her head and puts on a habit and yells, "Holy Mother, I am yours. Let us now see what excommunicated wretch will dare to drag a spouse of Christ from her monastery." And she will not take her habit off.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of remarkable, though, that she's not harmed when she's taken from the convent. She's kept safe by her escort, who behaves quite honorably, but she has to ride through the city of Florence in her habit on a donkey, and it's a scary, terrible ride. She can hear the anti-Medici people yelling at her on the street, but she's not harmed. She's dropped off at Santa Lucia Convent again, the place where she started this whole odyssey, and soon enough, Clement has Florence again, and Catherine is safe.
So Catherine is shipped off to Rome to live with her great aunt, Lucrezia Salviata, who is Lorenzo the Magnificent's daughter. And with the Medici back on top, it is time to make a marriage match, perhaps one with France. So now we're going to take you over to another country.
And another sad childhood. So Catherine's intended, Henry, is born 2 weeks before her. And his mother dies when he's 5 years old, but the worst childhood trauma comes a year later.
And to understand that, we're going to have to go a little bit back into his father's life. So his father, Francis, was obsessed with Italian conquests as a young man, and this earned him the hostility of Charles I of Spain, who later became our old friend, the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. And in 1525, Francis had a stupendous loss against the imperial troops in Pavia, Italy. He was overly brave on the field, his nobles were cut down around him, and he manages to get himself captured and taken to Barcelona.
Francis is treated well by Charles, but he gets depressed, you know, not being able to do the things he's used to doing as King of France. He stops eating, he gets sick, and Charles is terrified that this priceless captive he has, this bargaining chip, is going to die on him. And Francis, fortunately, starts to get a little better. The two monarchs start to work out the Treaty of Madrid in 1526. And this results in huge sacrifices of territory from Francis.
It's a bad deal.
It's a very bad deal. But of course, he's not in a position to bargain here. He's held prisoner. Also, it's going to result in a royal marriage. The widower Francis is going to marry Charles's widowed sister. But to be sure that Francis goes out and actually fulfills these territory handovers and keeps up his end of the deal, Charles is going to need a little collateral. And so they work out a deal where, in Francis's stead, Charles will hold the Dauphin Francois and Henry, 8 and 6 year old boys.
Yeah, kids for collateral. That's very nice. The boys are brought by their grandmother to the borderlands, and the exchange takes place on a raft in a river, which is very strange.
Yeah.
It's like two rafts coming from
two
opposite sides.
Two boats coming out to the raft.
And then there's the
switching.
Switch. And as a note, this will come up a bit later, one woman in the boys' departing group is 25-year-old Diane de Poitiers, who gives Henry a kiss, and later she becomes his mistress for the rest of his life.
And kind of the bane of Catherine de Medici's existence. So Francis is really upset at the handoff. He's sad to be giving his sons up as prisoners. He promises them that he'll try to bring them home soon, but really he has no intention of fulfilling the terms of this treaty. So the likelihood that the boys are going to come home anytime soon is slim to none.
Their initial captivity is fine. They're staying with their future stepmother, Eleanor, and they have this large French household. But as Francis becomes more rebellious, you know, starting the League of Cognac, for instance, the kids are basically put on lockdown and moved deeper and deeper into Spain.
And just to compare this again to Catherine's childhood, since it is so interesting that this future couple is in captivity at the same time, this is around the same time that imperial forces are sacking Rome and Catherine's hiding in the convent. But by 1529, things have gotten worse for the prisoners, and a French spy is found near where they're being kept. So they're moved even deeper into Spain, to Pedraza, and the only member of their once enormous suite of tutors and maids and valets and friends that's left is a single French dwarf who's there to entertain them.
Ultimately, they're moved to a cell with 10-foot-thick walls, bars, and straw mattresses. They have no companions, no education, and no exercise. But in the meantime, the years of war have made France and Spain very ready for peace, even if their actual rulers are not. And the ladies have to be brought in to work it out, since Francis and Charles can't seem to do it. So La Pex des Dames, with Francis's mom and Charles's aunt, secures the boys' release for quite a bit of money instead of territory, and Francis sets to raising it and getting his boys back.
And surprisingly, the boys are in pretty good shape, considering the severity of their final time in prison. Henry's 11 now, the Dauphin is 12, but they're different kids. They're not these happy-go-lucky French princes that left. They're gloomy Spanish kids who have grown up in prison. And to make matters worse, their father doesn't even like them very much anymore, and he definitely favors his younger son, who's gotten to still have his happy French prince childhood. He says that the mark of a Frenchman was to be always gay and lively, and he also says that he has no time for dreamy, sullen, sleepy children. I just want to be like, Francis, they've been in prison for 4.5 years. Give them a break.
Quit being a darling.
Yeah.
But it's time to start looking for a bride for Henry, regardless of his dreamy sullenness. A match with Mary Tudor falls through, so Francis goes to his friend Clement, the Pope, and enter Catherine in Henry's life.
And this is to be a triumphant marriage for Clement and for Francis, who have both been pretty disgraced recently. This is their chance to show the world that they're back on top and they're making this great alliance. And the marriage between these two prison-raised kids is going to be pretty impressive, too. Isabella d'Este helps prepare Catherine. Just to get an idea of her trousseau, Isabella requires 3 pounds of gold, 2 pounds of silver, 2 pounds of silk. All of that is just for gowns. She also gets pearls, and these pearls turn out to be pretty notable because Catherine gives them to her future daughter-in-law, Mary Stuart, who, when she's beheaded, Elizabeth I ends up with them.
Apparently that's how you get pearls. She also has a crystal casket, enormous diamonds, emeralds, rubies. Catherine is set as far as trousseau go. And she starts her journey to Marseille in 1533. There are, of course, very elaborate marriage festivities that go on for days and days, but they're finally married by contract October 27th, 1533, and they have their religious ceremony the next day. Catherine is dressed in gold brocade with a velvet corsage covered in gems and edged in ermine. She has jewels in her hair and a crown on her head, so quite the lovely bride.
And the Pope and Francis really want to make sure that these two 14-year-olds consummate their marriage, and consequently they're really creepy about it. They might even stay in the room to make sure that everything happens as it should. But after that's done, everybody's free to go home, and they exchange some parting gifts. And one of the special gifts the Pope gives the king is a unicorn tusk, which Katie was really excited about.
Because it is, of course, actually a narwhal tusk. And anyone at How Stuff Works in the editorial department, I think, knows how obsessed with them I am. I wrote an article, if you want to go look for it, on our homepage.
So Catherine's a duchess now. She's gone from this sort of derogatory term, a merchant's daughter. She's clearly no merchant's daughter, but, you know, the Medicis have their reputations. But regardless, she is a duchess now, and it seems like things are going to be pretty great for her, except that the first major blow to her married life comes less than a year after the wedding, when Clement dies, and he hasn't fully paid her dowry, and he hasn't fulfilled all his promises to King Francis. And so consequently, Francis feels like he's gotten a pretty bum deal with marrying his son to Catherine. And he says that the girl has come to me stark naked.
Another big problem is that Catherine can't seem to conceive, and this is a major issue when Henry's brother, the Dauphin, dies apparently after an exhausting game of tennis.
Just an embarrassing way to go.
It really is. 17-year-old Henry has a daughter by an Italian woman, so it seems that the problem isn't him, and he's urged to repudiate Catherine. But Francis likes her a lot. She's smart, she's sporting, she may have brought side saddle to France, in fact, and she can handle his body jokes. She's a good match for him. And so he becomes her ally.
Yeah, her father-in-law. So Catherine steps up her attempts to conceive a notch, and she gets these weird medicines, tries all sorts of strange potions out, and she watches Henry and his mistress Dionne through a hole drilled in the floor to see what they're doing, maybe find out if she's doing something wrong. Although apparently she's so sad watching this that the tears blur her vision. Eventually, the couple gets a medical examination, which shows that both of them are slightly abnormal, which we have to wonder what
that means. Been detailed. We're not sure.
But they're given some instruction. It seems to work because she's soon pregnant, and she has a boy, Francis, followed by 9 more children. So whatever they learn certainly works for them.
And an important note for our next episode, Catherine is a two-parter. The survivors, except for one, are sickly children. They've got weak lungs, the boys have sores and fits of dementia that may have been from congenital syphilis, so file that one away. But while marriage isn't easy, neither is jousting, and at 28, Henry and Catherine become king and queen of France when Francis dies. Catherine sincerely mourned the old king. He taught her a lot about regal style and helped inspire her love of architecture and art. And for the next decade or so, she absorbed herself in her family life, although she had to contend with a very pushy third party in her marriage, Dionne de Poitiers.
But the king grows to respect his wife more and more, to pay more attention to her, probably because he is grateful she's borne him so many children. And he starts to trust her, too. He gives her the regency several times when he's away on campaigns. But still, her role is mostly being a mother and being a lady of the court. By the time she's 40, life seems to be going fairly well. After all these years of expensive wars with France and Spain over Italy, there's going to be peace, finally, and it's going to be marked by 2 royal marriages. And to celebrate, Henry is going to host festivities. He, his sons, and his court will joust, despite Catherine's fears and her foreboding sense of doom.
And she thinks she has a second sight, so this is a big deal. Her astrologers have warned her that there's going to be trouble, and Nostradamus has predicted disaster. She's dreamt of blood and gore. There is no good that will come out of this particular jousting tournament.
And so on Friday, June 30th, 1559, after several successful runs, Henry II is struck down with a lance through the eye and brain. It takes him 10 agonizing days to die, and he leaves his 15-year-old son, Francis, who is weak in mind and body, as King of France. And the grieving widow, Catherine, turns out to be willing to do anything to protect her children's birthright. But that's going to be the subject for our next episode, which will also be our exciting conclusion of the Medici Super Series.
So leaving you with that, we will now go to listener mail, which is about the Medici, appropriately enough. This message is from Jeremy in Juno Beach, Florida. He wrote to us, "I've been listening to these podcasts and found it all very familiar." This is in regard to the Pazzi conspiracy, by the way. "The game Assassin's Creed 2 takes place in Renaissance Italy, and a portion of the story includes the Medici and Pazzi takeover. The game used some of the history for the story and is pretty accurate with your podcast. There is also a downloadable addition to the game named Bonfire of the Vanities. I haven't played it yet, but it's about a religious zealot that takes over Florence and starts burning books, like the podcast on Savonarola. Nothing spectacular by any stretch, but figured you'd be interested in the history aspect of the game." And we are indeed. We'd also like to remind you that we get a lot of suggestions on both our Facebook fan page and on our Twitter feed at Myst in History. So you should come and find us. And if you'd like to check out my article on narwhals, because you know you want to, you can find it on our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. And be sure to check out the Stuff You Missed in History Class blog on the howstuffworks.com homepage.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit TomboyX.com to shop.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done. Outfit stunner. And my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch, so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com. /compatibility.